dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle. And let's begin exploring the wine glass. Today, I am sharing the audio from a webinar I attended late last year, sponsored by the Wine Scholar Guild, on the wines of Georgia. It was an intriguing webinar, jam-packed with so much information. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, you know that many ask for Patreon. We do not plan on doing this, but we do ask for your support by leaving us a review. It only takes a few seconds of your time, but means so much to the show. The next best way to support Exploring the Wine Glass is to tell your friends. If you enjoy the podcast, your wine-loving friends will too. Finally, don't forget to head to the website, exploringthewineglass.com, to read the blog and to sign up for the newsletter so you can keep up with all the happenings. Sláinte! I would like to thank MXSandy12 for leaving this 5-star review. Perfect wine pod. So informative and captivating. Thank you so much, MXSandy12. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to leave the review. Sláinte! Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Spanish wine scholar, Sommelier Service, Champagne and Côte d'Aron specialist, and a WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. Stay in the know about all things wine by visiting my website, exploringthewineglass.com. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Wines of Georgia. We are so glad that you are here, and we're joined by two amazing hosts that I'll introduce in just a few moments. My name is Sharon. I'm part of the Wine Scholar Guild team, a specialty program. And for those of you that might not know about Wine Scholar Guild, we were founded in about 2005, and we're the leading global provider of specialized certifications on wine, specifically France, Italy, and Spain, with some master programs tied in there. You can do these courses either in person or online. Just visit winescholarguild.com to learn more about us. We also do immersive study tours, which some hands-on and some great folks lead those. Andrew's led a few of them in the past. And we also have memberships, and memberships afford you that opportunity to get free webinars every single week from our Masters of Wine, leading winemakers, wine producers, distributors, and some hot topics. Recently, Andrew just led the conversation on typicity. So again, great opportunity, great organization, especially for a wine student or a wine aficionado. A little bit first about our two hosts today. So Sarah needs no introduction. Neither of them need an introduction. Sarah became a Master of Wine in 2008 after 10 years of working in sales and sourcing and education. She founded at 2008, a strategic consulting and communications business called Swirl. If you're not already participating in Swirl, she's an author, speaker, wine judge, and she has regular routine articles in the swirl.com site. So definitely check her out on Swirl. And joining her today is our very own academic advisor, Andrew Jefford. Andrew is, I love this quote, the wine writer's wine writer. And if you are not familiar with any and all of his books, from the New France to most recently Drinking with the Valkyries, published in 2022, he writes frequent articles for Decanter, The Guardian, Financial Times, and he's also the co-chair of the Decanter World Wine Awards. As our academic advisor, Andrew provides strategic advice on our development plans, liaison wine creators, and communicators of the industry. So welcome both of you guys. There we go. I'm going to let Andrew kind of start us off.
Apologies, everyone. I'm just getting over a horrible tickly cough, so bear with me. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all and to see you all here. And I'd like to start by handing over to Andrew. Andrew, tell us about how you discovered Georgia, your take on Georgia, etc.
Sure. While Sarah recovers her voice. Well, I first went to Georgia back in 2013. It was actually a super important visit for me. It was almost like, you know, a pilgrimage. Over the previous few years, I've been reading a lot of the works of Patrick McGovern. Some of you may know his books, Uncorking the Past, Ancient Wine. He's the leading researcher, really, into ancient residues in pots, and in particular, those that have bearing on alcoholic beverages. So he's, I guess, the world's leading expert in the very early days of alcoholic beverages. And through his work and his books, we knew that the cradle of wine, broadly speaking, was somewhere in Georgia, in Anatolia, in the Near East, down into to present-day Iran and so on. At that stage, when I went in 2013, we didn't have the two discoveries that have subsequently been made in Lower Kartli, which really prove that the earliest ever residues of pure wine, in other words, wine without resin or without other things added to it or without without alcohol being, as it were, fermented from other things other than grapes, the earliest pure residues we have do come from these two villages in Lower Kartli, and they date back 8,000 years. So I was really keen to get to Georgia. As I say, it was almost like a pilgrimage for me. I discovered three things, really. I mean, the first was a culture of enormous richness, a wine culture of enormous richness, almost 500, over 500 indigenous varieties, and of course the use of Clevery fermentation methods, which really go back, as far as we know, as far as wine culture itself does in Georgia. So in a way, tasting traditional Georgian wine is like time travel. I mean, I went to Tbilisi and Kakheti in 2013, but I also felt I was going back thousands and thousands of years. That was one thing. Another thing I discovered was that it's not just a historical curiosity, of course. There's lots of contemporary winemaking in Georgia, and I discovered aromas and flavors that were unique and compelling that you won't really find anywhere else. And of course, we'll have a chance to talk all about that a bit later when we do some tasting together. And I suppose the third source of amazement was on that and subsequent visits, because I've been back four or five times since, was the way in which wine is really embedded in national life in Georgia. I think 8% of the agricultural land in Georgia is devoted to vines. France only has 3.23% by comparison. I remember when I went there the first time, the vine leaf was the symbol of the Ministry of Agriculture. They have changed it subsequently, but that was true then. And of course, the famous grapevine cross, St. Nino's Cross, as it's called, a symbol of the Georgian Orthodox Church, you know, involves grapevines. That this cross is actually made of grapevines. There's a story behind all of that. Monasteries are still significant wine producers in Georgia. And when I went there, I didn't just meet winemakers. I also met Metropolitan Bishop David of Alaverdi. And I just want to read out a little quote, something he said to me at the time, because it has bearing on this third point. I'm quoting now. In the Georgian countryside, he said, having a vineyard is like having a house. It's something you couldn't live without. I grew up in Tbilisi, he said, in a flat, but my parents used to bring grapes in from the countryside and make their own wine in barrels on our balcony. Many people do this without realizing why they are doing it. This is absolutely amazing. And I then discovered, in fact, that when you looked at the statistics for wine production in Georgia, most Georgian wine is actually made by private citizens at home, by people literally making wine in barrels on balconies, up to 80 million liters a year, almost twice as much as the official production. So in many, many ways, Georgia really is wine central. And even though it's still finding its way back into global appreciation, finding its way towards articulating a wine culture with the sophistication that we're familiar with in France or Italy and California. Of course, it's slightly been a victim of its own geography. It finds itself in a difficult neighborhood over the last 150 years. And of course, a victim of the history that's followed on all of that. This really is wine central. And I believe the wine world needs to cherish it and help it on its way. And Sarah, came up with a very good phrase last time on our last webinar. She called it the baby phoenix, and I really like that phrase. It is a phoenix in that it's rising again from the ashes of all the traumas of the last 150 years, but it is a baby. It's still finding its way forward. We all know that you only get to do wine once a year, needs time, all of these things. But it is definitely moving its way forward with great determination and rapidity. And, you know, it's always a privilege and a pleasure to be there. And it's a place that really holds it's really very dear to my heart when I think about the wine world. Georgia, Wine Central, it's the place. Anyway, Sarah, take us back
down
to
Thank you, Andrew. One of the things I do is I advise the producers in the National Wine Agency of Georgia. And I would just like to say that you're like a superhero in Georgia. They are so appreciative of the sympathy and the sensitivity you have for their culture. And so thank you for being with us today and for your open mind and consideration for exploring the wines. So I'm going to do a very quick recap on the context for Georgia. Some of this we did cover in more detail last week. I'm going to whiz through today because we really want to spend some time talking about the wines. I appreciate that not all of you have been able to source wines. We'll talk about that in a few moments, about the reasons for that in a few moments. But we're going to still use the wines as like jumping off points for talking about particular aspects of Georgian wine, such as grape variety, winemaking methods and terroirs and so on. So where is Georgia? As Andrew said, it's in some ways a difficult neighbourhood. In some ways, though, a blessed neighbourhood. I mean, this is a place of grace when it comes to nature. Everything grows here, but it is surrounded by large and historically covetous, and in fact still covetous, neighbours. So Russia to the north, Turkey to the southwest, and then Armenia and Azerbaijan to the south and east. And the topography of Georgia is really worth looking at. So you see this huge range of the Caucasus Mountains to the north. And this is what protects Georgia from the cold, harsh weather to the north, and then also shelters Georgia from the more extreme weather coming from the south. So Georgia is a place where everything grows. As someone I know, Lisa Granick, once said to me, she said it was like Florida for Russians, you know. It has this really benign climate, but actually a temperate benign climate of warmth, sun, but also nuance. And the main thing to bear in mind with Georgia is that there are two very different climatic regions. And the center of the country here is pretty much divided between east and west by this land bridge. And to the east, this is the warmest, sunniest part of the country. And you can see this wide valley opening out to the southeast, where you have warmer influences are coming from Iran and the Arabian Peninsula, moderated by the proximity to the sea, the Caspian Sea. And then to the west, you have a much more verdant, hilly, temperate climate, much higher rainfall, higher humidity, and the climate here is really moderated and tempered by the proximity of the Black Sea. And this diversity in terroir, this split in the topography, really explains the enormous diversity that's to be found in Georgian wine styles. Very diverse climatic zones, but generally summers are warm and sunny, winters are cool to cold, with snow in some zones. So there's ski resorts in Georgia. I will share this, as I said, afterwards, but essentially this goes into a little more detail, but you get the idea. Annual precipitation in the east, 300 to 800 millimetres. In the west, 500 to 1,000 millimetres a year of rain. So you get the idea that you've got two very different climates here, and we're going to be talking about wines from these influenced by these different climates. Just a little bit on the regions. Wine is grown all over Georgia, and there are officially designated regions. The biggest by far in terms of production is Kakheti. 70% of Georgian wine is actually white, 30% is red, although the reds are starting to creep up. Kakheti is really the home of the most powerful Georgian wines, powerful reds from Saparavi, and wonderful amber wines from Katateli, Mutsvani, Kakuri, Kisi, Kikvi. Every region has its own specialized clutch of regional grapes. And what you will find is that the grape varieties over here in the West are all characterized by thicker skins and naturally fresh acidity. And of course, they're adapted to the higher humidity here. Something that the latest research has shown is that these Georgian grape varieties, which are the enormous treasure of Georgia, really are a kind of bridge genetically between the wild vine and cultivated vine. And so this is, I think, although Georgian heritage, the Kvevri, is really captivating, the great treasure of Georgia is this almost beautiful cul-de-sac of amazing vinifera varieties, which are not found anywhere else. And we're going to be exploring and talking about some of them today. This is a little bit about Kakheti, and just to go into the sort of the redevelopment of the Georgian wine culture. So Georgia in the 1800s had a flourishing of its first sort of fine wine aspirational culture. We'll be talking about that when we taste some of the wines. But then under the Soviet Union, although Georgia was producing an enormous amount of wine, the wine industry, well, it was heavily industrialized and homogenized. But despite that, they've made very rapid progress in the last 20, 30 years in really rediscovering and retracking their terroir. And you can see that even in this, so this is a map of Kakheti, the main region to the southeast. And this topography will actually be very familiar to students of wine. We've all seen these before: mountain ranges, faults, different exposures, the proximity to the river, the different aspects giving these very distinctive terroirs, which are then expressed through different wines. So these are just some of the most famous in Georgia denomination or appellation wines. And we're going to be talking about some of these as we go through and taste as well. Very diverse terrain. So the slide, two slides back, was a picture of Kakheti, which showed this high plateau but flat vineyard with the major Caucasus, the majestic Caucasus, as a background. Here we have a few clips of other vineyards in other areas. So Kartli, where we're going to be trying wines from this producer, Mukrani, today. Kartli's in the center of Georgia. Moving west of Kartli, this is a typical vineyard of Imereti. You see this patchwork, densely wooded, very lush and green, almost sort of subalpine feel. Further west of all, you're getting into Guria. So this is towards the Black Sea climate. They grow tea in this area, so it has that kind of richness and lushness. And then this is all the way down right in Meskheti, which is on the border with Turkey. And you can start to see this rather epic, uncompromising sort of stony landscape. So it's really Multum in Parvo, Georgia. This is Racha Lehumi, which is right up in the north. These wines from these areas are becoming slightly more commonly exported, but not as available as the wines from Kakheti and Kartli. There's an enormous diversity of Georgian grapes. And Andrew, I know you share my excitement about frolicking through and discovering these. We're going to be tasting some of them in a moment. And I mean, I just think, for me, the thing I find, the thread that runs through Georgian native grapes, is that you can tell this is a culture that's obsessed with food. They often remind me of, you know, the Italian kind of balance that you get, in that they have texture, the aromas tend to be on the back palate, you know, they have a slightly sort of sitting back quality, and they're really interested in texture and freshness. And although there are still three main varieties that dominate production, which is Rakazzatelli, Saparavi, and Mutsvani, all of these varieties on here, for example, are now being made commercially, and there are many more of the 500 that have been restored and are being made commercially. So it's like being present, almost the rebirth of a wine nation when you go to Georgia. And this, for me, is one of the most exciting parts about exploring Georgian wine. And I think it's just worth bearing in mind that the Iron Curtain came down and we were separated from this incredibly rich culture, and the culture itself was squeezed and restricted. I was talking to a Georgian wine professional, a young woman, when I was last there, and she said, we just feel that we've started to like breathe again. And they're very concerned about current developments in the region, but wine is really seen by Georgians as an expression of their creative and national sort of benign, it's like a benign nationalism, or certainly a kind of resurgence of their expression of their individuality. And I think this figure here, this enormous increase in the number of independent registered wineries. So this is a nation with 3.5 million people. It's roughly the size of Scotland. And there are thousands of small wineries, as Andrew alluded to, and everyone's a winemaker. And lots of these family wineries and vineyards have been restored and brought back into commercial production by their young people. So it's a really thrilling place just to go and visit for what's happening now. Never mind what happened 8,000 years ago, important though that was. So we're going to move to talking about the wines. And I appreciate that not everybody has the same wines, but I hope we can still make this lively and engaging for you by using the wines to jump off as discussion points for the information on the grape varieties and winemaking techniques. And it's worth just saying that, as I alluded to, this break with the West, that Georgians today even still feel a lot of regret about. You know, Georgians feel that they look West, even though they have one foot in Asia. And in fact, when you go to Tbilisi or Georgia, isn't it sometimes, Andrew, you walk down one street and you could be in Vienna and you turn a corner and you could be in somewhere in Asia, you turn another corner and it's sort of, you know, Soviet brutalist architecture. It's enormously varied. But for the Georgians, after the Russian economic sanctions of 2006, the Georgian wine industry was nearly eradicated. Well, that was Putin's aim. He wanted to bring them to heel. But that was the inflection point at which the industry in Georgia realized we have to basically build new markets. But until that point, something like 99% of Georgian wines were exported to Russia and the former Soviet Union. So really, we've only known about them for a matter of decades, and it takes time to build these distribution networks. So this is why the availability of certain Georgian wines is quite fragmented. You'll have some brands in some states, some wines in some states, but not others, etc. But thank you all for your time in coming and paying them attention, because this is all the kind of buzz and consideration that helps to build their markets, because we buy the wines they want to make. So with that, we can discuss the wines. I've got a picture of the wine so people can see the bottle. I know you wanted to say something about the packaging as well, Andrew, but do you want to take us through this wine?
Okay, so I've just poured a glass of this first wine, Gurule Mustvane. Mustvane, the word just means green, and there are at least three, perhaps more, Sarah can probably correct me on that, versions.
Seven.
Of Mustvane. There you go. Yeah. Seven greens. But two are very famous. This is one of the famous ones. The other one is the Cachetti version. There's also a Rajuli version that I've tried, and probably Sarah's tried all the rest too. They are actually completely separate varieties, or I believe they are. Certainly the Guruli one and the Cachetti one are completely separate varieties.
Yeah, and they're all completely separate genetically.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so there we go. And this is a wine made by Chateau Mukhrani, top producer. You saw the beautiful chateau. It's one of the sort of, you know, the slightly old aristocratic producers, lovely estate, sometimes owned by foreign capital, sometimes owned by Georgian capital. But I'm you know, thoroughly behind that development, as just as much as the sort of indigenous small producer element that we've heard a lot about, because Georgia really needs both if it's going to move forward. And this is a wine made in what we could call the international style. It's not made in Kerevri or anything like that. Like about 90%, I believe, Sarah, of Georgian wine, it's made in what we could call an international or a contemporary style rather
than
the ancient
style. Call it classical.
Classical, there we are. Yeah,
but by which they mean not Kerevri.
Yeah. And again, you know, I think that's very important for several reasons. First of all, that wines like that are most intelligible for new consumers to come to terms with, whereas new consumers are sometimes a little befuddled or bamboozled by the Kerevri versions. That's one thing. The other thing I think is quite important to say is that, you know, you saw from what Sarah just said, this huge range of grape varieties, and we're still discovering most of them. I mean, most of the wines are produced from four varieties at the moment. Okay, we've got that one, I think, is coming, the Tobino, coming in a minute. Approach, or the classical approach, is that you can actually get the varietal character coming through quite clearly in a way that you don't, or at least you won't, unless you're a very experienced taster, find that in a Kerevri style. Anybody who's interested in what Georgia's wonderful patrimony of grape varieties have to offer, I think the classical style is the best way to approach that. Anyway, let's taste this wine. I love this wine. Beautiful, fresh, pristine, almost crystalline character it has. As Sarah said very wisely again a little bit earlier, often with Georgian varieties, the aromatics are really on the palate as much as on the nose. But this does have some genuinely nose-perceived aromatics. I don't know how we would say a smell of spring plants, something like that, a subtle yes. floral quality. The smell of running water moving through a forest, something like that. All quite subtle and understated, but definitely it's there. And then you find that really amplified on the palate. Those floral perfumes come out actually quite clearly on the palate. What flowers? I don't know, freesias, honeysuckle, something like that. Delicate yes. notes.
Yeah, it is. It's Mizfani is one of the most almost floral and expressive of in an aroma of all the Georgian varieties, and is all the Mizfanis are expressive in this way, even though they're technical varieties. And it's like it's become a catch-all word for, oh, that's the aromatic white variety of that region, you know, so we'll call it Mizfani. Yeah. I don't know whether it's just my word association, but I do sometimes find, especially with the other Mizfani, what we could talk about, it reminds me a little bit of Gruner Veltliner, that kind of slightly more expressive floral aromatic
and you know, delicate fruits, I mean perhaps a bit of apple fruit, pear fruit, green grape, something like that, and then just a little sort of speckle of a stone dust at the end. But really wonderful control and definition and purity. I don't recall when I first went to Georgia tasting wines like this, made with this level of focus and pristine purity. And that's something quite new in the classical style, and I'm really happy to see it. Patrick Honeff, who makes this wine, is very adept winemaker. And also, perhaps we should also speak here, Sarah, about the Guruli style, the fact that this is from Kartli. You know, Sarah spoke a little bit earlier about the sort of ridge in the middle of the country. I think it's called the Liki Range.
Yes.
Which is, in fact, the watershed between the Black Sea and is it the Sea of Azov, the other side?
Yes.
The two big seas, anyway.
And the Caspian, I think it's the Caspian.
The Caspian.
Yes.
So it's a real hinge in the whole of the Caucasus. And this wine is actually grown up on that hinge, a little bit cooler. So you don't get the sort of the firmness and the emphatic quality that you'll get in Cacheti wines very often. But I think what Patrick's captured very well in this wine is the sort of the restraint and the delicacy of it. And I think if, you know, I don't know what sort of image people have about Georgian wine when they first come to it. But they might think, you know, crikey, this place is almost in Iran. You know, it must be stinking hot and getting this really heavy style or whatever. But this is completely the antithesis of that, the perfect wine to serve to anybody who has that kind of a stereotype about what Georgia might be.
Well, you know, the people in Kartli call the Kakhetians, you know how people have regional teasing nicknames for each other, and they call the Kakhetians like the donkeys. So, like, you know, they're like these, and there's, oh, you know, their wines are a bit like that. So there are some wonderful wines being made there, but they're known for this, you know, a certain emphatic quality, big presence, big weight. And that's also the homeland of the really deep, full skin maceration amber wines, Kakheti. And Kartli is the aristocratic seat of Georgia. So Kartli puts the cart in Skartvelo, which is what the Georgians call their country. And it's where you had all of the princes and princesses of the during the Russian Empire had their country estates, of which Mukhrani was one. And in fact, it was restored through a public-private partnership, and it's now fully restored. And they hold the most incredibly gorgeous wine festival there every year, which I always find a lot of Italians are at, nicely enough. You know, so and it's always breezy when you go to Kartli, and it's gently hilly. It's green. You can see it's much greener than when you go out to Kakheti. And they make these very elegant wines in both whites and reds. And it's become a bit of a hotspot for visits because it's easy to get to from the capital. So you can sign up for a wine tour and you could be there in sort of 30, 40 minutes. And I love showing people this wine because if they've had only Georgian amber wines before and slightly freaked out by them, I love showing them the delicacy but yet the succulence of this wine. That's a picture of Garuli Mutsvani, and it always has these little black dots.
Okay, so our second wine is again classical style and from another distinguished aristocratic estate. In fact, probably the most distinguished aristocratic estate of all in terms of its some sort of imperial past, I believe, Sarah.
Yes. So Zinandali was the seat of Georgian literary romanticism. It was the palace of Alexander Chavchavadze, who in the 18th, Georgia had this sort of golden period where they were incredibly optimistic about their future as a prosperous and independent nation. And Chavchavadze was an aristocrat, but a very enlightened one. And one of the reasons that he was so keen on establishing vineyards is that he'd done a lot of research into agriculture and new methods of agriculture, because as the prince and the landowner, he was responsible for the well-being of, you know, the feudal families who were semi-feudal, who were living on his land. But this was a time when they were very influenced by the new ideas of romanticism and the nobility of man, you know, that were those ideas that were doing rounds at the time. And around this time, so this is the late 1800s, was when you had a big influence from France coming into Georgian winemaking via the influences of the Russian court. Because although Georgia would every now and again sort of try and leave the kind of the orbit of the Russian imperial network, the powerful Georgian princes at the time had all grown up with the Russian princes. So they were all sort of quite matey. And they were, when the Georgians were always being forgiven for you know, agitating for independence. So anyway, this was the time. So Zinandali, I've got a picture of it a bit later, which shows the estate, was really at the time one of the most innovative, quality-driven estates. And Zinandali is in Kakheti. It's on the bank of the Alazani River. I can flip back at the end and show you exactly where it is on the map. but it's a really great terroir. It's gentle, very sort of undulating or even flat land, but very nice terroir for both white and red grapes. And it gave its name to the most famous Georgian white, which traditionally is a blend of Riccatatelli and Mutsfani. The reason I thought it'd be nice to try this is because this palace has now been completely restored, again, in a public-private partnership. The prince lost everything because he had to sell everything to rescue his wife and daughter who had been ransomed by the barbarians. Anyway, you can see I've gone down a rabbit hole with this, can't you? But anyway, it's been restored. The vineyards are all chateau style around the restored estate, and you can even go and stay there and swim in the pool. But I know that's not necessarily pertinent to the wine, but anyway, very sort of lovely, fresh, but succulent style of wine.
Yes, I mean, succulent's the word. It's a real contrast to the first wine. Also, we should say that it's not actually 100% an estate wine. I'm sure there's some estate fruit in it, but it's actually quite a complex blend of different varieties, as you can see from Sarah's notes. And it also comes from several different regions. It doesn't just come from Cochetti. It also comes from further west, Imereti, I believe, as well, some of the components in the wine. So it's very much a sort of cross-regional pan-Georgian blend. And once you can see by the colour, you won't be able to see particularly. You probably can. You can see it's quite a gold wine. It's a deeper coloured wine than the first wine we had. When you sniff, well, what should we say? It's much more sort of southern in style. You can sense the warmth creeping in there. There's some oak influence there, I think, as well. I don't necessarily like doing this, but sometimes it's quite useful to have some analogies from elsewhere. So if you could sort of imagine a cross between White Hermitage and White Chateauneuf-du-Pape, in a way, it smells a little bit like that. Very structured, very broad aromas, quite rich. The smell of, chestnuts, honey, things like that. Definitely got plenty of aroma on the nose. You don't have to just wait until you get it on the palate before you get that aromatic style. And then on the palate, very rich. I mean, there's some residual sugar in there. Mouth-filling, mellow, autumnal. There are some tannins, even though it's not a Kvevri wine at all. But I can pick up some of that on my tongue. So definitely quite thick textured white. Very much late summer fruit. Absolutely, Jim. Yes, that's absolutely right. It does, if you want an analogy. And then flavor-wise, we're talking about, apricot, honeydew, melon, things like that. But it does have fresh grape acidity to keep it, which works very well with the light tannins to give it balance and poise. Perhaps, texturally, I think Rhone, but almost in flavor. Some of you may know Pacherenc, down from southwest France. It's sort of a bit more like that than I would say on the palate than it is Rhone, perhaps. Very unique, lots of complexity. So, sometimes very complex blends, you almost think, oh, what's the point? All those great varieties in there, and it is not very complex. This one really is quite complex. The blenders work well. I'd love to know from the winemakers if they went through lots of trials before arriving at this particular blend. Sarah, you wouldn't happen to know that.
Yeah, I've been there and I've spoken to the winemaking team, and yes, they did. I think the aromatic profile of this wine really is marked by this variety here, Kirvi, which is one of the most gloriously intense, flavorful Georgian varieties. I know what you mean, Andrew, about being cautious at saying, oh, it's like the Georgian version of such and such. But I think because all of these grape varieties are so new, I'm kind of at peace with it. And the Georgians don't seem to mind when you say things like, oh, it's almost like a cross between like Viognier and, Marsanne or something. Hivi has got real, almost extravagance, but yet a deepness, a depth as well. And then Solicari and Tetra, as you say, are the varieties from the West. Solitary has lovely, crackling, crunchy acidity. And Tetra is also known for this sort of very almost like, you know, those green plums that you get in that part of the world, Turkey and Georgia, really crunchy green plums. Tetra is considered to have that kind of fruit character. But I know that they did. This style of wine, cross-regional blend, not amber, although it's had a little bit of skins, you know, just 4 days. And with this blend of varieties, this is a really quite a new style. It's like the Georgians are realizing they can kind of have some fun. And I'm a big fan of this kind of style because I think it's all part of the Georgians having the confidence to play with all of these resources, to, you know, to start using this palette again. And I think it's very important that they can take what they have and keep renewing and refreshing it, for today's consumer. So just because the conventional blend was Sinandale, Riccatelli, and Mizvani, there's no reason at all that you shouldn't have a play and see what works with other varieties. So I do have a real soft spot for this wine. And it's actually what I think of as a good kind of winter white. You know, it's got that kind of extra richness.
And just a lovely contrast to the Mukrani Mustvane, Guruli Mustvane, which is so pristine and delicate and ballerina-like. This is, as Sarah says, much more statuesque.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Dracaena Wines loves to give back. There are so many fur babies that deserve to find their forever home. We would love to be able to help as many as possible. If you are part of a nonprofit organization or know of a nonprofit organization that would like to hold a fundraiser, please contact us at contact@dracaenawines.com or visit our website, dracaenawines.com, to fill out the form. How does the fundraiser work? It is super simple and costs your group absolutely nothing. Together, we will choose a month that your group will be sponsored. During the month, you promote the fundraiser just like any other event you'd hold. At the end of the month, we will donate 20% of the sales to your organization. The donations will be made in the name of each individual who purchased the wine so that you know exactly who helped the animals. Our goal is to raise as much funds as we possibly can and to help as many animals as possible. So please help us help as many fur babies as we possibly can.
Okay.
Oh, and I just wondered, so this is where Sinandale is. So this is the denomination of Sinandale. So this is where this palace is located. Oh, that's the restored palace. Isn't it cute? It just looks like a kind of fairy house.
You can imagine sitting out on the balcony there on long summer evenings.
It's heaven, honestly, the gardens. You really, and this was, but he had visitors from all over the world entertained here. And then during the Civil War, it had bullet holes and stuff in it. And this is, you know, but the palace has been restored. The winery is brand new and at the back, and it's but it's all very beautifully done. But the whole park is a national monument, but they're working vineyards. And in many other countries, that would be a bit of a naff tourist attraction. But actually, I'm sure you found this, Andrew, when you went for Georgians, lots of very serious wine businesses have really lovely enotourism, and it's part of their business model because they really want to get people there. Okay, so you've got the Tibulvino Mizvane, I believe.
Yes, I have. Let me just get that up off the floor. Yes, here it is. It's kind of difficult to get the label into focus, but anyway, I'll pour the wine. So this is Mustvani from Kakori, of course, and this again is a wine which has really a lot of aroma. You don't have to wait to the palate and go searching on the palate. It's definitely comes out and meets you once you get your nose into the glass. Packed with sort of hedgerow fragrance. Again, it sort of reminds me rather of Northern Rhone, not definitely Northern Rhone this time, and something with Yonier in and a bit of Condria, that sort of apricot, floral apricot charm, definitely on the nose, but very different to the last wine on the palate. Much less, Well, really, I mean, in terms of weight, it's between wine one and wine two, mid-weight, I would say. Lovely, fresh structuring acidity to it. Lots and lots of Mayflower and white flower perfumes. A lovely, juicy, grainy mid-palate. You know, just because this wine will be produced, I think, in quite large quantities, Sarah, is that right?
Yes, it is. I really respect and admire this producer. It was established by two brothers in the late 1990s, and it's just worth recapping and bearing in mind that when the Soviet Union was broken up in 1991, although there was a great sense of sort of joy in Georgia that they were establishing themselves as an independent country, actually the state, just imagine the state just disappearing overnight, and it was extremely tough times. You know, the banks ran out of money, or, you know, people's savings were wiped out overnight, salaries weren't paid, there was no heating, and then of course there was a civil war. But actually, so many of the producers who are doing really well now were founded, sort of scrabbled together by young Georgians who were in their 20s and 30s at that time, saying, we've got to keep making wine. And Tibble Vino have been really pushing forward with that. And I really like their approach. I've been to the winery many times, and it's not a sort of a fancy, beautiful looking winery like Mukrani and Zinandali, but it's impeccably run. And they work with both stainless steel and sort of classical technology, and also Crèvery. But from the very beginning, the brothers brought in experts and advisors from Australia, from France, from Italy. They were really outward looking, and they wanted to be very Georgian, but not to be solipsistic about it. So very good producer. And in fact, they've in the UK, certainly they've had a lot of success. So they're now in Marks & Spencer's, they're in Waitrose, they're in Majestic, they're in Lathwaite's. And that's wonderful for Georgia, because we need the wines to be there in kind of in the places where normal people just go and pick up a bottle, rather than geeks like us who will do anything to search out the specific thing. Mutsvani is a really good variety. So this is Kakuri Mutsvani, which is the Mutsvani of Kakheti. And it does look a little different. You see, it's got this slightly bigger berries compared to the Garuli Mutsvani. But again, it has this crisp, quite filigree kind of aroma and perfume to it. It has a precision, but also a breadth. And it makes excellent Crèvery wine, skin contact wine, as well as really lovely classical stainless steel wine. I've had it where it's been fermented in stainless steel and aged in oak, and I find those less convincing. Whereas Riccazzatelli aged in oak, I think, can actually be quite nice. As it mentions here, it is an aromatic variety, but it oxidizes easily, and so that's something I think that they also they've got so much better at. That Tibble Vino Mutsvani, I think certainly in the UK, you know, it retails at about £11. It's very good value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, terrific value and a great introduction, actually.
Yes, exactly. That's another one you could show to people and it wouldn't freak them out.
Yeah.
Unlike Amber Crèvery.
Okay, well, we move to a Crèvery wine now. I mentioned Bishop David, who I met on my first visit a little bit earlier. I must just read you what he said to me about Crèvery wine, because it's very beautiful and I've often thought about it since. Here we go, I'm quoting. God created man from clay. Crèvery are made from clay and lie up to their necks in the earth. They give birth to wine like a mother to a child from within and from within the earth. Then the wines age like a child grows. The whole process is like a prayer. And I then asked him whether wine's made in Kvevri, you know, I was sort of sniffed a little journalistic quote or two here. So I said, well, you know, a wine's made in Kvevri more spiritual than conventionally made wines. I fully agree, he said, but it would be a bit pretentious to say it loudly. Perhaps we can say that wines which have lost their stems and their skins very early are motherless. So anyway, lovely quotes about Kvevri from Bishop David.
That's actually what they call wine made without without the skins. They call it udedo,
which means motherless.
Udedo means motherless.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, when we come to wines like this, we need to remember that, you know, for me, this is the sixth category of wine. We have our conventional five categories of wine. We have white wine, we have red wine, we have pink wine, we have fortified wine, we have sparkling wine. But you could add amber wine or orange wine, if you prefer, as the sixth category, because it's so completely different from everything else. But of course, there are various degrees of difference. And when you begin to taste different Kvevri wines, you discover that as with red wine, as with white wine, there's a huge spectrum of different stylistic possibilities. And I think this is quite a good introduction, Sarah. Let's see if we can see the color here. Yeah, I mean, you can see the color is a light gold. It's not a deep amber by any means. It's quite light in color. And it's also relatively delicate in aroma. It doesn't come out and shock you. And then in flavor too. I mean, as soon as you get in the mouth, you can see the textures and you'll be aware of, you know, the texture dimension to it. But sometimes the aromas of Kvevri wines can be very strong. These are quite delicate. I always think with, you know, the aromas of wines made in Kvevri, almost regardless of variety, you have to sort of completely change your sort of elusive repertoire, the repertoire you're thinking of, and think of things. I mean, for me, umami is often a character that you find both aromatically and on the flavor. Mushrooms, particularly sort of Japanese mushrooms, and protein. I mean, you know, soya protein, cheeses sometimes, straw, which has had cheese in, those sort of things. Those are things you can often come across in the aromas. And you get that in this wine quite delicately. I mean, it's quite nutty as well, sort of creamy. The young hazelnuts, which get called cob nuts in Britain, very fresh hazelnuts. That's something that you can smell in this wine too. And then on the palate, it's a very good introduction to Kvevri because it's quite light, quite fresh, quite delicate. You can see the tannins, you can feel the tannins, but they're not heavy. And there are no sort of overt, obviously demanding or confronting aromas to it. It's all of the things I described on the aroma are there on the palate, but in quite light, delicate, well-ordered and brightly focused style.
I think that's a really wonderful summary. I mean, I think part of that is down to the grape variety.
Okay.
So this is Kisi, which is a variety that had nearly died out in Georgia, but that has become resurgent. It's very much a variety of Kakheti, and it's late budding. It retains its acidity, but it ripens before Rakazzatelli, and it just has this kind of lightness, but with a gentle but precise aromatic character. And I often find with amber wines that with Kisi, it's like they just hold it, they're just a little bit more finely etched. They have a delicacy of texture. But basically, the way it was brought back is that some old vineyards really that were being grown, you know, by, as you were saying, Andrew, everyone has a plot somewhere. I mean, lots of these kind of, but basically all this sort of great granddad's plot or great grandma's plot have really come into their own as the rediscovery of these varieties and the reintroduction of these varieties has developed. And Tel Aviv is a real centre for Kisi. It's considered to be a great spot for it. And it's also made in the classical style. So stainless steel fermented, and that's when you get these really bright, quite fruity pear and citrus aromas. Sometimes Georgians will say, oh, this is a bit like our Sauvignon Blanc. I mean, in a way, it's not, but they just mean it's this kind of quite nervy, bright, you know, high-toned style without necessarily having the weight or the breadth that you can get in Riccazzatelli. And this wine I really like showing to people, especially if they haven't had an amber wine before, because I think there's an idea that all amber wines are basically put there to kind of shock and test you. But this has had full skin fermentation in Crèverie for 6 months. But I mean, it's very pure, precise, nicely balanced. It's absolutely wonderful with food. So it's delicious with sort of a lovely plate of like nuts and ripened, you know, creamy rind cheese, that kind of thing. But I think it's a nice introduction to that Crèverie style. Do you want to talk about the Orgo?
Yes. Well, any wine with the name Orgo on the label is always a treat. Gogi Dakashvili, really, for me, the most craftsmanlike of all of the great traditional Georgian winemakers. Hugely fastidious in his approach, and you know, somebody who really stresses always that you can't. It's, you know, even though the Crèverie method of making wine is so ancient, it has to be done with great precision and great care and close supervision if you're going to avoid any of the disastrous things going wrong in it that can go wrong. So really a name to look out for if you really want to explore the traditional style. You can see by the color we have see if I can get it in the focal point. Yeah, much deeper orange here. This is made from Riccazzatelli, of course. All of those things that were just tiny hints in the previous wine, suddenly the volume has been turned up. Lovely deep notes, beautiful harmony though as well, nothing coarse at all of those things I was going on about, Japanese mushrooms and apricots and cheese rind and fermented fruits in general, and lovely sort of fresh umami that some of you may know, Japanese green tea and the umami notes that has, and there's almost that here as well. It's a much more concentrated wine. It's very pure once again, absolutely pristine, nothing at all sort of musty or grubby in it at all, absolutely impeccable definition and cleanliness to it. The tannins are there, but they're quite fine. I mean, you know, I've had plenty of Crèverie wines with much richer, thicker tannins than this. They're quite fine and delicate. They lend this dimension and serious quality and lovely flavor complexity when the wine finishes as well. The mushrooms, the apricots, the cheese, the tofu, touch of autumn apple as well. Really beautifully harmonious, beautifully drawn, lovely precision, lovely finesse, an absolutely impeccable example of the traditional style at its very best. So well done, Gogi, as usual.
Yeah, actually, I have a bit of a, when I say a crush, you know, you just admire someone so much. I thought I might just show you this photo of myself looking adoringly at Gogi. So this is this is the view from his winery, his family winery.
He's
a very modest.
He is. He's super modest. It's true.
Discreet chap, but when you speak to him and you get him to start talking about himself a bit more, you realize he's had the most incredibly influential career. So he was a young man in the 1990s. He was one of the co-founders of the previous winery of Teliani Valley, which they founded in a former garage workshop, you know, car machine workshop. Scrambled it all together with a bit of a wing and a prayer. But he, from his 20s, started really making what he would call the Crèverie notebooks. So he said, we must keep this going. And he did so much research and so many trials working out why Crèverie had been designed in this way. why they were the shape and the form and the material they were, and why you should bother to keep using them. And he had also, I mean, he'd done, you know, three different types of organic and inorganic chemistry at university in Odessa and blah, blah, blah. He'd studied at, excuse me, he went on to study at UC Davis. You know, he's a technical enologist, but he really has been very instrumental in also helping and teaching the generation how to deploy Kvevri for the aim that they were designed for, which is to make very clear, stable, beautiful, not oxidized, pure, clean wine. And he's basically obsessed with hygiene. He's like the tidiest, cleanest person you've ever seen. You could have surgery on his Marani floor. But wonderful wine, makes a wide range of wines, and this is enormously successful in the UK. And he's also the consultant to Schuckmann, which is an enormous winery co-owned with a German investor, which does very good wines, much more sort of broad commercial wines. But yeah, wonderful. And I don't have it, so I can't taste it with you, but I know it very well. Excuse me, a little bit about Rocazzatelli. So there's more Rocazzatelli planted in Georgia than anything else. And familiarity sort of breeds contempt. But you could think of Rocazzatelli in some ways as a bit like the Trebbiano. It has lots of different clones. It has an interaction with completely mediocre anonymous wine. But actually, lots of winemakers, and Gogi is one of them, says, no, you know, if you work with Rocazzatelli in the right way, it's your wine, it's the winemaker's best friend. So it can be made, I think it's, I love it as a Kvevri wine. I think it's wonderful, but also it can be made in stainless steel, oak. Sometimes it's blended with Chardonnay quite successfully. And the stem is quite often used, especially in Cacchetti, because Rocazzatelli means red stem. So in a good warm year, when the stem is mature, that will actually, they'll be partly dried and then put into the Kvevri for fermentation. I thought it would be a nice point to say something about Kvevri winemaking. Is that okay? I hope I'm not coughing too much. I beg your pardon. So Georgian Kvevri, as you were saying, Andrew, made of clay. The clay is sourced from specific sites. So you can't just go and pick up any old clay and make it. And in fact, they're starting to control access to the clay because there's a concern about, you know, the demand. Because what's happened with Kvevri is that the demand for Kvevri has soared. When I first went to Georgia about 8 years ago, I went to visit one of the Kvevri winemakers. And the difference in the intervening years, you know, I go back, he's got a really nice new car. He's a really keen gardener. He has a beautiful landscape garden. And that's all sort of expresses and highlights just the huge demand for Kvevri. So their clay, they were designed 8,000 years ago to solve winemaking problems. They're wood fired. So they're not fired in a modern ceramic kiln, which means they're not fired at really high, the high temperatures that you get in a modern kiln, so they're slightly more porous, and typically they are lined with beeswax to reduce the porosity and to make them easier to clean, because it's all about cleaning. This is some Kvevri just after they've been fired, so this is a wood-fired kiln, and there's no gauge or thermometer. The Kvevri makers, of which there are three or four key families whose practitioners have learned the methods from their fathers and grandfathers. I've never met a lady Kvevri winemaker, but maybe there will be one in the future. And then you can see that they're actually installed. This is actually a photograph of Kvevri's being dug in Plumpton in Sussex in England, because they have a Kvevri cellar there. Again, more Kvevri being installed. This is Zaza Vilashvili, who's the Kvevri winemaker, and you can see they start a bit like a sausage pot and they're grown up, and he'll be making sort of 6 to 8 at the time, and they come up and they're made in the cool wet months of the winter, they're fired in the summer, ready for the new harvest. So there's a kind of seasonality Kvevri that matches the, if you like, the seasonality of wine. And then typically a Kvevri Marani will be at ground level, open to the air, must be well ventilated. And then you can see the Kvevri openings are in here. And they're very beautiful spaces. They do have a sense of a sacred space about them. I think with all of these circles and just the architecture of these places. And in fact, Georgians told me that often in difficult times, they couldn't get access to a church. They wanted to do a christening. They would do it in a Marani and that kind of thing, that they would stand in for sacred spaces. Quite often you will read or people will say, oh, Quevri, they're so hands off. Basically, you just throw all the grapes in, seal it up and let them get on with it and open it 6 months later. In fact, that's not true. Quevri solve a lot of winemaking problems, and the practitioners, the winemakers who are using Quevri, are really well aware of how to use them to achieve that. So the shape of the Quevri with this high shoulder promotes great fermentation kinetics. It also assists with cap management, so that you have a thin, well aerated and easily punched down cap at the top level of the Quevri here. You have, it says here, a natural level of pressing. Sorry, my mouse has become extremely sensitive. And then at the end of fermentation, as the carbon dioxide stops being produced and the cap and all the sediment falls down here, the seeds, the grape seeds, which are heaviest and contain the most bitter phenols, are kept away from the wine in this tip. The skins go on top, and the fresh and the sort of the, if you like, the best fraction of the wine is up here. And winemakers use this knowledge in their Quevri. So they might just say, I know I'm only using this first level of the fraction, and then I'll see what goes on here. I might add some of that back as a kind of press wine. Controlling Quevri because they are moderated through contact with the earth. And I think this is the important thing to remember about Quevri, that especially, and then when they're closed and left to age, it's not oxidative, it's reductive. It's a reductive, protective aging that helps to clarify the wine. So 8,000 years ago, when humans were working out, oh, we can make wine, they didn't just want it to be booze. They wanted it to be beautiful and tasty and stable. And I think that's the amazing thing about Quevri. Sorry, I'm conscious of the time. We're kind of racing through. So I'm very happy to answer any more questions about Quevri, either here or as a follow-up. So no problem if you do have any other questions. But we'll move on to the next wine. So you've got the unfiltered Saparavi.
Yeah. Well, here we go. You can see that the colour is absolutely saturatedly deep. Midnight deep black red, definitely unfiltered there. Saparavi, I know Sarah's very keen on Saparavi. I'm super keen on Saparavi as well. Sarah said last week that it was maybe the world's great undiscovered great grape, red grape variety, and I could buy into that too. And we should also say that it would be the only one of amongst those which actually has red grape juice as well as skins. It is a Tinturier variety, and you probably know Alicante Boucher and one or two others in Western Europe, but this is really the great one in that style. And this is, again, from Tiliani, a wonderful introduction to the style. It's straightforward. It's exuberant. It gives you all of the generosity and the excitement of the variety in sort of fairly unsophisticated but beautifully cleanly delivered style. So you get this wonderful dense colour. You've got scents of blackberry and plum and dug earth in the autumn. Very exuberant, very appetising. And then when you sip it, well, you'll certainly notice the tannin. But the tannins are actually very soft. They're not hard or brutal at all. Ample textures. It's probably much fresher on the palate than you expect from the nose, because you get all this sweet fruit on the nose and you think, gosh, that'll be ripe. But in fact, it isn't enormously ripe. It's only 13.5 and it's very fresh and bright with its acid balance. And also, you know, the sort of things I was describing on the nose, the blackberry and the plum, those are very sweet fruits. Once it comes onto the palate, it may remind you more of sort of elderberry or even rosehip or something like that, some sort of wild but fresh hedgerow style fruit. I think another thing with Saparavi, although I don't find it so much in this wine, perhaps in one of the wines we'll come to in a minute or two, there's a sort of fascinating, exotic sort of incense-like note to the fruit as well, which has nothing to do with wood. I mean, very often when you come across incense notes in Western European wines, it's to do with the oak aging. That's not true at all here. In fact, I'm not even sure this wine has any oak aging. It seems to me completely clean and steel fermented. Is that right, Sarah?
If it's, you've got the unfiltered, is it Saperavi or Saperavi unfiltered?
It's Saperavi unfiltered, it says.
There's a little bit of oak aging, yes,
okay,
but
right, well, anyway.
It's not new oak. It
certainly doesn't get in the way. And then at the very end of the palate, it, you know, finally it just turns a bit more savoury, despite all the fruit. So just a super satisfying, enormously generous red wine. I mean, sometimes I think that Saperavi could almost be described as the beast from the east. but this one isn't very beastly. It's very friendly. Yeah. It's got its arm around you. It's you know, you can tickle its tummy and it won't come and bite you. It's absolutely delicious, friendly, welcoming Saperavi.
Yes. You're right. I am obsessed with Saperavi. I think it's one of the greatest grape varieties that most people haven't heard of yet. And it's increasing in plantings in Georgia, but also I've seen it increase in plantings in other parts of the world. So King Valley in Australia, there's some Saperavi being trialled in Montalcino. It's up in...
And by the way, Hugh Hamilton in McLaren Vale, they make some terrific a range of Saperavi.
Oh, I haven't tried theirs.
Yeah. Oh, you should look those out, and they're wonderfully labelled too.
Yes. Ukraine makes some really delicious Saperavi. And it's the variety, I think, that Georgians are probably most excited about because, I mean, it has a big personality, but there's something still really, as you say, welcoming about it. And it doesn't have like Cabernet Sauvignon type tannins. It has almost cushiony, pillowy tannins. You know, it has a really like almost shag pile texture quite often. You know, you sort of sink into it. I also find it incredibly diverse and versatile. Some of the really warm terroirs in Cacchetti, such as Mucazzani and Kinsmorale, they can late pick it, they can really get it ripe, and you can make really quite big wines of up to like 14% alcohol. But actually, most Saperavi achieves really great intensity and impact, even when it's about 13 to 13.5%. And Georgians will say to you, "Oh, Saperavi is really long lived," and then you'll say, "Well, have you got any? I can try." And what happened during the Soviet era is because it was this whole transactional wine factory one, wine factory two, that so all the factories were state controlled and just given numbers. And this the sophisticated wine culture that you alluded to at the beginning, that you will find, say, in France or even Italy, where it's this sense of we need to build our library. How do we get better? Let's go back and taste how the, you know, 2010s are tasting now. Georgia's had to rebuild all of that. So I think we're just starting to see what Saperavi can do, but it's cold hardy, keeps its acidity. It can give great quality, even at not particularly low yields. And it has a lot of genetic interaction with site. So there's a lot of clones that are specific to site, which the Georgians are really getting excited about and doing different things with. And they all used to be quite big and hefty and hulking when I first went there a few years ago. But I think also there's a lot more of restraint and confidence in taking the foot off the gas. So yeah, Saperavi, it's wonderful. And also, well, when I speak to retailers and importers in the UK who are working with it, they say, do you know what? If you get Saperavi in, people just love it. You know, it flies off the shelves. So I think it's probably Georgia's great hope. You've got a more, we've got a more sort of nuanced style with the red from Mukrani.
Yes, and from Kartli as well, of course, different region.
Kartli, yes, yes.
I think it's worth saying at this point, very briefly, that Kvevri red and Kvevri white are completely different things for the simple reason that Kvevri red is really the whey is produced in the way that all reds are produced. It just so happens to be made in a Kvevri rather than something else. Whereas Kvevri white is dramatically different because it's an amber wine. It's not the way in white wine is normally made. Therefore much more. That to me, the sixth category of wine is Kvevri white wine, which makes amber wine. Whereas Kvevri red is a different category. It's produced essentially in the same way as all red wines. It just so happens to be produced that way in a Kvevri. What we've got here is a blend of Saporavi with Cabernet Sauvignon. And as again, I think Sarah pointed out last week, Cabernet Sauvignon has been in Georgia for a very long time. It's not a new variety there at all. Not indigenous quite, but almost indigenized because it's been so long. When you sniff this wine, you can definitely sniff the 18 months in oak. That is an element of the wine on the aroma for sure. But on the palate, I think it works really well. It's deep and it's dense. You have this vitality and fruited energy that we spoke about with Saporavi a minute or two ago. But there's more secondary qualities here. You know, the oak is works very well on the palate, I think, bringing a little refinement, a little more complexity, some savoury notes, a bit more savoury note than you saw in the very fruity wine that we began with. Very complete. What's the Cabernet bringing? Perhaps the Cabernet is bringing a little bit of central palate wealth, because what you tend to notice with the Saporavi is you'll notice the tannins on the first palate when you first sip it, and then you'll notice the distinctive fresh, forest-fresh fruits and vivacity at the end. But sometimes it doesn't quite have the flesh of the central palate that one might hope for. And the Cabernet Sauvignon, I think, brings that to this particular wine. Lovely, broad, full, complex, almost, you know, a little bit of salty chocolate at the end. Again, perhaps tickled on by the oak there. So a beautiful blend, very different to our first wine. And interesting to see Saporavi in a slightly different incarnation.
Yes, and there is a PDO for Cabernet Sauvignon in Georgia, which is called Teliani, somewhat confusingly, but it can actually be rather good. I've also had very good Kvevri Cabernet Sauvignon in Georgia, although, as you say, it's not such a departure from standard red wine making. But yeah, I'm starting to see a little bit more international varieties being planted, especially by the youngsters in Georgia, as I've come across a bit of Syrah, Sauvignon Blanc, of course, you know, but it's very rare. They're nearly all their indigenous grapes. So, and I think you have another red. You have the Chab Capito as well. Is that
yes?
Right?
I do. Very keen to talk about this as well, because you can easily have the impression, you know, because Saporavi is so much the main story as far as red wine and from Georgia is concerned, you know, that all Georgian wines must be like that, very deep, very hearty, very rugby player-like. Well, here's something that absolutely isn't like that at all. I'll try and get it into the focal. I don't know if you can see there, but this is a much, much lighter, much, much clearer wine. It's almost like, you know, come to this wine after the Saporavi, it's almost like, you know, coming to a well-aged Barolo after a Madiron or something like that. And very different style of aromas, delicate currants here, some floral aromas even, you know, rose petals, something like that. And then on the palate, rather light, rather delicate, lots of finesse to it, sort of somewhere halfway between, you know, Nebbiolo and Pinot. Doesn't quite have the tannic firmness of Nebbiolo, doesn't quite have the sort of fruited aerial grace of Pinot, but somewhere between those two, but with the distinctive Georgian, that sort of creeping incense-like exoticism coming into the flavours as well. Basically, the flavours are sort of currenty, but there's also that exotic note, that incense note, and that earthy note too as well. But within what is in a very sort of light midweight, poised, elegant, refreshing style of red wine.
And I really agree. It reminds me of that Italian sour, sweet floral tension thing that goes on. And actually, it's very alluring and kind of tender. You know, it's just
tender. Tender is a good word.
Lovely. Absolutely. Variety. And the first time I had this variety, so Chef Capito was another one of these varieties that nearly died out. It was indigenous to Kartli. And Chateau Mukrani were very key in basically bringing it back and expanding their plantings. And it's becoming more widely planted now. But the first time I had it was actually sitting on their lawn. So on this kind of restored aristocratic lawn under the trees with this beautiful, you know, filigree curved, you know, wooden pagoda with the trees around you and the breeze sort of, you know, playing with your hair. And it's got that sort of legerity and fineness to it. And I think that I really love showing people these wines, because both in Kartli and then also in the West, you do have these lovely, bright, dancing styles of red, which are so lively. And there's such a lovely counterpoint to the Saparavi, which is such a crowd pleaser, you know, a big, bold crowd pleaser. And then you've got these actually very subtle, surprisingly subtle, delicate wines. I think this is also drinking really well now. Mine is vintage 2019 and it's just got going, I would say.
Well, I got 2020, so I'm one ahead, but it's also, I mean, it's beautifully balanced and aged. You don't get any sense of it being consumed too soon or anything like that. I think also that it's a lovely example of the Kartli style in red wine. It's exactly what you expect from this slightly higher central site. I think Chef Capito really suits the Kartli style very well. So I'm sure we'll hear more about that wine from Kartli in the future.
Yes.
And there's the fairy tale property.
This is the restored. And you can see, so you've got the foothills of the mountains in the background. This is the restored property. But the vineyards are absolutely taken seriously. But you can go there and join in this wine festival, which is becoming a bit of an international thing. And this kind of level of aspiration, I think, is really important for Georgia. So vineyards around the property. And so on. And then I think we have one more wine.
Yes, we do. And this is actually a PDO wine, isn't it? It's our first, yes, PDO wine today, Sarah. I think it might be.
It is, yes. Yeah.
And I'll get it into the focal. You can see it's obviously based on Saparavi, so you get this wonderful depth of colour. But this is Saparavi in a very different mood to, certainly to the first wine we tasted. It's a slightly older vintage. I've got 2020 again. Lots of finesse. The oak, I have to say, is done with more restraint on this wine than actually the previous wine, certainly aromatically. Perhaps that's really a reflection of the way that Saparavi can soak up oak in a way perhaps that Chef Capito can't. Lovely finesse and poise. Something that makes you again think of Northern Italian styles, I would say, to this wine. A secondary refinement to it. The primary fruit has really disappeared now. And what you're tasting is very much the sort of... something which is worth saying about Saparavi. I noticed, because I've taken part in international Saparavi competitions. I've been judging Saparavi with lots of Georgians. And I remember that, you know, I was always very fond of the really young ones, and they were very dismissive of those, and they hated giving high scores to a young Saparavi. But once they'd had a little age, they were ready to give them much, much higher scores. And Saparavi actually ages remarkably swiftly. Within 4 or 5 years, it can completely spin on its heels and turn about and become a very different sort of variety, It can acquire its secondary characteristics much more swiftly than many other varieties. So if you are a little bit disconcerted by a young Saparavi, it's really worth seeking out something with a little bit more age. This is only 2020, but already you've and because of the handling and so on, you've lost that primary confrontational mode, and it's got into this much more refined secondary style.
I think there's something about this style of Saparavi. So Mukazani is a name to conjure with, or it was, you know, the PDO was there because there was this great interaction with Sai. And it's almost like scratching a slightly sort of exotic Bordeaux itch or something, you know, it has that sort of that weight, that rhythm through the palate, that kind of oak aged. It used to have to be aged for longer than 12 months. There was a higher minimum requirement, and in fact that has recently been reduced for the PDO, which I think is really intelligent, because
I agree,
you know what can happen, you know, there's an idea, wasn't it, that really comes from an old-fashioned way of making wine that then so you create an obdurate beast and then you have to soften it for 3 years in old oak, you know. Mm-hmm. And but you know, funnily enough, what we see in our market is that the PDO names like Sinandali, Mukazani, even Naparuli, they have no power here. We find it much easier, and retailers and importers are much more taken with the varieties, especially like Saparavi is easy to say, you know, Kisi is relatively easy to say. And but I do think that it's important to still tell the stories of these PDOs, because it does plug into this more continuation of culture, of fine wine culture. I really love this producer, Vasi Subani Estate, overseen by Lado Uzanashvili, who's the most amazingly dynamic guy and definitely someone you'd want on your Armageddon team. He's making very good wine there again in this restored estate. They also make a range called George and Son, which is really jolly, like well-priced, accessible styles of wine, which are well worth seeking out if you could find them. But yes, there you go. Saparavi, the greatest variety you've never heard of. This is a map of the Mukazani terroir. Another amazing source for information on Georgian wine, by the way, is this source here, Georgian Wine Club. If you have a look at the Georgian Wine Club website, led by Malchaz Karbardia, the most wonderfully cultured and well-read expert. Great resources and maps and so on there. Oh, do you want to wrap up and say any more about this wine? And I'm conscious we've gone slightly over time. I'm sorry about that. But
we have 5 questions, so perhaps we ought to quickly jump through those.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Very informative and lots of great conversations in the chat too. So I'm going to actually summarize some of the questions. One that's come up a couple of times is, could Andrew expand on why he believes the Cuvée Rhines show less varietal character than a classically styled wine? And that's been a theme actually throughout the chat and everything else. What is the key difference between Cuvée and classical style?
Well, the thing with Cuvée is you're suddenly coming across this wonderful contact it has with all of the fermentation. You're coming across the contact it has with its skins and with its stems sometimes, and with its pips as well. And all of these are building a layers of flavor and aroma into the wine of themselves, which have nothing to do with varietal character. Mm. When you have a white wine where varietal character is the main attraction, you're stripping away all of those things. You're taking them away. In order to privilege or focus on the varietal character, if you like. In many ways, that's what classic white wine vinification is all about. Whereas in a Cuvée, that's not true. You're building this wealth of aroma and flavor from these other things. Now, you know, it may be, I'd love to talk at some length to Georgian wine tasters about this, because it may be that this is simply my inexperience coming to the fore, and I'm noticing all of these other things and tasting these other things, which they as it were, would be able to see through, and they can see through to the varietal character as it's expressed via the Cuvée style. But speaking as a sort of innocent taster who is coming to these relatively late in life, that's what I tend to notice. Okay. So when I taste a Cuvée wine, I'm sort of assessing how successful it is as a Cuvée wine. I'm perfectly prepared to believe that its success is predicated to some extent on variety in place. But what I'm sort of looking at is this extraordinary wealth, this motherly wealth that it's delivering to me. I want to revel in that rather than think too much about actually what variety it's made from.
Thank you for that. Sarah, any additions to that conversation? Quavery versus classical.
When Andrew pointed out that you're dealing with a real additional richness of compounds, you know, phenolic acids, some other phenolic compounds that are part of the composition of amber wine. When I tasted alongside Georgian tasters, and we're tasting blind and tasting amber wine, and they'll be like, oh, this is Kissy. You know, this is a Mizfani. And I guess, like, imagine if you hadn't never tried red wine before, and you were just given a whole flight of deep, intense red wines. Would you be able immediately to perceive Cabernet Sauvignon and Syrah, you know, or would that be, is it because it's part of our wine education and lexicon that we're brought up to recognize and then articulate these differences and these varieties that no one's even tried? So I think amber wine should not taste of the Quavery. It shouldn't be privileging oxidative characters or even, you know, microbiological characters over the purity of the wine. I think it's more to do with our interaction with the wine and our sort of, oh my God, look at this weird, you know, fifth element or, you know, sixth art form that's come up that we're now dealing with.
But there's much more to say on this, and I hope, you know,
there is, yeah.
We'll all have a
perhaps another whole conversation, another yeah, webinar.
Yeah.
This question came up, and I know, Sarah, you've been answering a bit of it, but for the good of the group, serving temperatures on orange wines, what are your thoughts? Because I loved your one response about it's yours to explore and treat it like a light red. But what say you to the good of the group? How would you serve an orange wine?
So I'm really bad at remembering what temperatures what, but I would probably serve it at around 13 to 14 degrees. So like a kind of, you know, a light bodied red,
mm-hmm,
rather than a chilled fridge white, especially amber wines from Cacchetti, which have had full skin contact for 6 months, all of the skins, maybe some stems. If I were having an amber Quavery wine from the West, where they might have only have 20% of the skins, then I'd probably serve it a little more chilled, or I might have a bit and think, oh, I might just stick this back in the fridge, you know, for a bit. Don't have it too cold. I would say it's better to treat it first like almost a light red and then chill it down. But, you know, the worst that can happen if you serve it too cold is you just have to cuddle it for a while and, you know, let it warm up. It basically pronounces the tannins,
mm-hmm,
and reduces the aromas. And I really love the aromas of Quavery wine, especially aged Quavery wine. I think they're really a massive part of the appeal.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. Thanks for the question. All right. So Bart writes, are there any hybrid grapes in Georgia? What rootstocks are they using? And thank you for a great presentation.
I haven't come across any hybrid grapes in Georgia, but I'm not sure if you were here for the first version of this webinar, the first episode of this webinar.
Mm-hmm.
Did share a slide and talk about this research, of which actually Lado Ozanishvili was one of the participants, where essentially it has shown that the genetics of Georgian varieties contain a relatively higher proportion of DNA from wild vines, from Silvestris, than the European cultivars, and that there's it basically supports this hypothesis that Georgian vinifera was sort of one of the earliest branches of domestication from the wild vine. So I haven't come across any deliberate hybrids. And in terms of rootstocks, that's a really good question, which I would want to check my notes on before answering. I think it's the usual suspects. I mean, Georgia has phylloxera. I haven't come across any phylloxera-free bits of Georgia, but there may well be some.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you for that. And for anybody that's asking, the article that Sarah's referencing is available in the Wine Scholar Guild community. If you just type in Wines of Georgia, you'll see last week's recording, any of the articles that she referenced, Lisa Granick's book is also highlighted there as well, too. So thank you for that question, Bart.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Book. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com and sign up for my newsletter at exploringthewineglass.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Podcast music is Wine by Kevins. Until next week, Sláinte. No, never let you go.